Hello, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm your host, reporter Joaquin Sapien, and I'm here with New York Times writer Dan Barry, author of the newly released Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. The book is an outgrowth of a series of stories Mr. Barry wrote for the Times in 2014. The series focused on an Iowa turkey ranch and the intellectually disabled men who labored in it for decades in exchange for minuscule pay and harsh treatment. Eventually, the ranch drew attention from state authorities who were stunned to find that such exploitation could persist for so long in plain view of townspeople who seemed so fond of the laborers. It was a devastating, fascinating series, and I've only just begun reading the book, but so far, it's even better. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Joaquin.
So I understand you first came across the story while you were working on your This Land column. Can you talk about the first moment that you heard of the ranch in Iowa and what you found intriguing about it?
Sure. I write the This Land column for the Times, and I basically wander around the country. I've been to all 50 states. And what I'll do sometimes is say, hey, I haven't been to Iowa lately, as we all do. And I'll visit Iowa virtually and read some websites and newspaper articles and such. And I came across really about a 100-word news brief. It was clearly a distillation of maybe an AP story that was a distillation of a Des Moines Register story. And it contained a series of phrases that just blew my mind. A $240 million verdict involving a group of 32 men with intellectual disability, living in an old schoolhouse for 35 years, working at a turkey processing plant for 35 years, doing the worst jobs in those plants, by the way, and being paid $65 a month plus room and board and in-kind services, which meant like camping trips occasionally or going to Walmart for 35 years. So in other words, they were paid $65 a month in 1974, and in 2009, they were still being paid $65 a month. And so those series of phrases took my breath away.
I mean, it's essentially slave labor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what happened was I really wanted to write about this. I really wanted to go to Iowa now. I was motivated to go to Iowa. And so I called the federal attorney who handled the lawsuit on behalf of these men. His name is Robert Canino, and he works for the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. And I said, look, I really want to write about this, but in order to do so, I need to talk to the men. I need to include them in their own narrative. I didn't want to be one of these reporters who would write around a class of people and not include them in their own story. And he said to me, no one has talked to the men. And I said, why not? And he said, because no one has asked. And that gave me pause. And it struck me that therein lay some of the issues here, that there's this otherness, that there's this separateness between the so-called non-disabled world and those with disability, in particular intellectual disability. Like, we don't include them in the conversation about them.
It's astonishing. So let's go a little further back in the chronology. How do these men come to live in Iowa?
Sure. It's interesting because all of the men are actually from Texas. So in the 60s and 70s, these men were young boys who had been dropped off at the gates of state institutions known as state schools in New York, not unlike Willowbrook. They all had intellectual disability, and in some circumstances, their families could not deal with them. They didn't have perhaps the emotional or even the financial wherewithal to raise a child with intellectual disability. Also, at that time, the theory was it's best if you have a child with intellectual disability to leave him or her at an institution. It's better for him, it's better for you, and the two of you will move forward in whatever relationship develops with one effectively warehoused and kind of an inside-outside world. In most cases, the men never saw their families again. That was it. They were dropped off. In some of the cases, you know, the men continue to have relationships with their families up until even today. So they're at these state schools. That's where they spend their formative years. And there's a movement to get the beds open, to make these guys taxpayers. But there's also kind of a smart thought here of including them in the community, right? And this is the way it is now. We, you know, it's inclusive rather than exclusive. So back in the 60s, it was kind of a combination of the cost involved, but also getting these guys out of these institutions, having them learn a skill, having dignity and self-respect. This was a big thought back then. So they were taken out of the state school and brought to a ranch, and they were taught a skill. And the skill was to catch turkeys. They were involved in the artificial insemination of turkeys, which is how the turkey that you and I eat now is made. It's all artificial insemination. They were quite good at it. And they lived on a ranch in kind of a bunkhouse, and they had a lot more freedom than they had in the warehousing of the institutions. Their overseers, two men who ran a business called Henry's Turkey Service, had the bright idea of subcontracting them out to places around the country where there were turkey processing plants. So some guys were sent to Illinois, some guys were sent to South Carolina, and a group of guys were sent to Iowa to a place called Adelissa, which is adjacent to a town where there's a huge turkey processing plant operation. And so the overseers rented an old schoolhouse, put a bunch of guys in there, and that became their lives for the next 35 years.
Talk about speaking to some of these men for the first time. It seems that part of the reason why no one had approached them in part was because they were traumatized, but also as a result of their disabilities, they're, you know, many of them can't communicate very well. You spent, I'd imagine, dozens of hours with them. What was it like to gain their trust and surmount, if you will, the barrier of communication?
All right, that's a good question. So there were 32 men who were part of this lawsuit. They were effectively the last guys in the bunkhouse when the gig was up, effectively. And there are 32 personalities and 32 individual experiences. We tend to lump them together, but each guy had his own journey, his own story. And each man had a different level of intellectual ability, okay? So some guys could not tell you what had happened to them. They didn't have the verbal skills, okay? A couple of guys were deaf, okay? But some guys could flat out tell you exactly what happened to them and reflect a little bit on it. The one issue that they all seemed to share, however, was a difficulty with the time continuum, okay? So if I said to Willie Levi, hey, Levi, when did you come to the bunkhouse here in Adelissa? He might say, well, it was last year, when in fact it was 35 years ago and not last year. But the stories that they tell are true, and I would corroborate it not only with talking to other men and talking to non-disabled people who worked with them and knew them from town, and then I came across a lot of documentation. So there was all sorts of triangulation occurring to corroborate the stories that these men were telling. But the first time I went to Iowa, I didn't bring a notebook or I didn't take my notebook out. It was really to say, hey, I'm Dan. I just want to get to know you guys and, you know, tell me your story. So the first visit or two really was just having coffee with them and listening to them and watching them go fishing one day and having them get used to me. And then, you know, hey, Levi, you mind if I talk to you for a minute? And he would tell me his story.
I don't know if I can even eat turkey again after reading some of your right. work the last couple of days.
But given that, these men had the worst jobs in this horrible workplace. And that included unloading the turkeys. So you'll see these turkey trucks on the highway sometimes. You know, they have holes in the sides for to allow air in for the fowl. And the trucks would come into a bay, and they would open up the crates, and the men had to reach in and grab these turkeys that weighed 40 and 50 pounds. These turkeys do not like to be touched, okay? And they're quite strong, so their wings are flapping. These guys knew that there was a technique to grab them by the legs, flip them upside down, and then hang them on shackles that were running kind of on a chain into the turkey plant. And then once the turkeys are in the turkey plant, they're kind of stunned, given a little electric shock. They're stunned. Then they're killed and they're bled out. Then these men were in charge of defeathering them. And then the turkey carcasses are eviscerated, and these guys had to reach into the carcasses and pull effectively the guts out and throw the guts into an offal, what they call the river, just a trough at the bottom of their feet. All day long, 10, 15, 20,000 birds a day, 5 days a week for 35 years.
You spoke with the guys who employed these men too, which is a significant reporting coup to get them to open up. And one thing that I found kind of extraordinary is that in some respects, these guys viewed themselves as sort of benevolent characters, that, you know, they were employing these men who had pretty limited capabilities and were helping to make them part of a community. So talk about first gaining access to the guys that were doing the employment and then, you know, what they sort of said about what they were doing.
Right. So there were two guys who ran this business called Henry's Turkey Service. One was named T.H. Johnson. He died several years ago. And the other was Kenneth Henry. He died just actually last month. And what they were doing was taking advantage of a federal law that allowed for kind of a prorated payment scale for people with disability. So the argument would be that Joaquin can hang 100 turkeys in an hour, okay? Dan, who has intellectual disability, can only do 74 turkeys in an hour. So that means that Dan should be paid 74% of what you earn, okay? And so each man would be given some kind of percentage of what a non-disabled worker could do in a given hour, okay? That was the arrangement. Totally ripe for exploitation and abuse. And they just made up the numbers effectively. And so every man got $65 a month plus room and board. That's where that money comes from. The overseers or the company owners really did see themselves as benevolent figures, as paternal figures. Their argument was that these men had effectively been abandoned by their families, most of them. They had been left at a state institution. No one gave a crap about them. We took them in. We had them living on a ranch. They had great food. We'd take them to the drive-in now and then. We taught them a skill, and we helped them gain their dignity. That's what the argument was. And they earned money. They became taxpayers in this system, and there's great self-respect in that. That was the argument that the owners had in 1974, and that was the argument that Kenneth Henry, the remaining employer, had when I visited him a couple of years ago. Even after the lawsuit, even after the company had been found lacking by a jury of their peers, he maintained, we were doing the right thing. Everyone is getting it wrong.
And take us into that moment, meeting him for the first time and hearing that argument.
You really just have to sit there and listen to it, don't you? So first, I was stunned that he agreed to see me, but also grateful, okay? And so I went down to Goldthwaite, Texas. He met me at the ranch where these men had been trained to work with turkeys initially before they went to Iowa. And it was heartbreaking because I met him in an old bunkhouse, and it still had photographs on the wall of all these men, okay? Some of the photographs have the men dressed as clowns because when they were living in Iowa, they would be dressed up as clowns sometimes for an annual fair. And he sat down and for two or three, almost 4 hours, made his case. You know, some of it didn't hold up under scrutiny, but he cried at one point, you know, and he would mention these guys by name, and he thought that he had done right by them, and he felt betrayed, and he felt horribly misunderstood.
And he says at some point that the men who all have pretty low IQ levels, very low IQ levels, had somehow hoodwinked the press and the state into, you know, thinking that they were mistreated?
That's correct. He refers to the men as boys. That's why it's called the Boys in the Bunkhouse, which, by the way, is another way of condescending to these men with intellectual disability. It's another form of otherness, separateness. Oh, here are these grown men, but, you know, they're really boys, so let's call them boys. So he would argue that they had done right by them. So what happened was after they were effectively rescued, after they were taken out of this bunkhouse in Iowa, they were assessed by the social workers. And the social workers would sit next to Willie Levi and say, Levi, tell me what happened, okay? And Levi would basically unload and say everything about it. They kicked me in the balls, they did this, they did that. Kenneth Henry's argument was that the men or the boys would say anything because here was a pretty young thing of a social worker smelling of perfume and being nice to him, and getting him a soda. And in exchange, he will tell that social worker whatever she wanted to hear. And almost all the social workers who worked in this case were women in dealing with the men. So he was effectively saying that the men had beguiled the social workers because they wanted to flirt with the social workers and told them whatever they wanted. And so that's how the men had hoodwinked everybody, including the lawyers, the social workers, all the assessment people.
I see. So let's back up another step and talk about how the whole thing kind of unraveled, that these men ended up being rescued.
Sure. So the men arrive in Adelissa, Iowa in 1974. They're housed in this schoolhouse that's kind of tricked out into a kind of a dormitory. And they get up at 3:30 in the morning, have a quick breakfast, and go to the turkey plant where they spend most of their days. That's how it is for many years. In the beginning, the bunkhouse is, you know, pretty nice. It has a gym, it has a pool table, they have TVs and all that kind of stuff. But as the years go by, the building declines, becomes more and more squalid. There's a cockroach infestation. The supervisors are not trained in dealing with people with intellectual disability. So it's just like people off the street dealing suddenly with 32 men with intellectual disability, and there's some challenges there and some care that needs to be provided. None of these people was trained in that. And so what happens is it devolves into more of an abusive relationship. The men are denied their basic rights. If they didn't work hard enough at the plant, they weren't allowed to watch TV. They weren't allowed to get out of the van to go to the mini mart and get some Mountain Dew or chew. They weren't allowed to go to church. There were all these things that were really denying them their basic rights, which feeds into that thought of it being virtual slavery, okay? So all around the country, the Americans with Disabilities Act is being employed. Their cohorts around the country, many of them, are experiencing inclusion rather than exclusion. And here are these guys hermetically sealed in this bunkhouse in Adelissa and being denied the right to say, you know what, I don't want to work today. Or, you know what, I'd rather work somewhere else. Or, you know what, I'd like to have a girlfriend. None of that was allowed to them. So it declines. One of the company owners dies after a long bout of alcoholism. And now these men are in their 60s and 70s, some of them. So they've spent their entire adult lives at this bunkhouse. So they're young men. Now they're old men, okay? And it's thought, well, you know what, they can't hit their numbers the way they used to. So let's retire them. So here, yet again, they don't have choice. They're being told they're being retired, okay? And there were all sorts of plans that fell through, but ultimately the plan was, let's just retire them and send them to some, you know, second-rate nursing home in Texas. That's what the plan was. So when the families who were still involved in the lives of these men were notified, hey, Kenneth, your brother Kenneth is now going to be living back down in Texas, one of the sisters called up the bosses and said, look, my brother Keith has been working for you guys for 35 years. How much does he have in the bank? And the answer was $86 after 35 years. Keith Brown had $86. So the sister hit the roof. She called everybody in Iowa. And she also called Clark Kaufman, an investigative reporter at the Des Moines Register. Now, it should be pointed out that over the course of those 35 years, many alarm bells had gone off. Many people had dropped dimes. Many investigators had stopped by, but no one paused long enough to say, this is screwed up, okay? So as early as 1974, a social worker writes a memorandum saying, this arrangement with Henry's Turkey Service there in Adelissa, this is slavery. This is screwed up. It's anathema to everything we stand for. This has to be stopped. It's horrible. It's like a 3 or 4 page memorandum thrown in the trash can. Nothing happened. And that memorandum proves prophetic, okay, to what happened to these men. So the sister drops a dime, calls everybody she can. A social worker gets that call. Imagine being a social worker getting that call. It's late at night. She's got a couple of kids. She's trying to put them in bed. And she hears effectively what I saw in that article several years later. 32 men with an intellectual disability living in an old bunkhouse, working at a turkey plant, getting paid nothing, getting kicked in the balls, being slapped on the backside of the heads, you know, all this kind of stuff is laid out. And the next morning she goes to the bunkhouse And it was like this twisted version of Alice in Wonderland. She opens the door, and there's this squalid environment, cockroaches all over the place, and men who clearly have been neglected approaching her and saying, "Hi, who are you?"
And eventually the place is sort of swarming with investigators at a variety of levels of oversight.
She has that holy shit moment, and she immediately calls her supervisors and alerts a series of law enforcement and other government regulatory agencies. And you're right, within several hours, it's like a crime scene. You know, there are all these like sedans pulled up on the lawn. There's all these investigators walking around going, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah, there's some beautifully written paragraphs that make the reader feel as though they're right there for much of that in both the book and in the story. And one thing that also stood out to me was the way that the town reacted. There were some people who were defensive and yet guilty about how this had gone on for so long. Talk about the town of Adelissa and what people knew about what was happening there and how they felt once it was shut down.
The story is filled with gray. You know, we'd like to frame it as a black and white situation, but there's a lot of grayness. So the people in Adelissa is about 200 or 300 people, really. There's a bar, there are a couple of churches, and a mini mart. That's pretty much what it is, and a silo. And the men began visiting the mini mart and going to the bars. And quite frankly, the town accepted them and included them and made a big deal about them at these parades where on occasion they'd be dressed up as clowns. And so there was great affection there. And they thought initially that these men were being taken care of because they had seen the bunkhouse in its earliest years and it looked all right to them. But they were never aware of the decline inside the bunkhouse, and they were never privy to the physical abuse that these men were subjected to. So what happened was they didn't notice. So here's Willie Levi, and he's walking kind of funny. You've known him for 20 years. He's walking kind of funny. It's because he has fungus growing up his legs, and he has a broken kneecap that's not being tended to, but you don't really notice that. And here's Henry Wilkins, and his hands are like crooked because they're constricted from the repetitive work of reaching into turkey carcasses and pulling out the guts, but you don't really notice that. And here's Jeff Long, and he has blood on the side of his mouth because he has a wire from some bad dental work sticking out and jabbing him in the cheek, but you don't really notice that because you're so familiar with Jeff and Henry and Levi. They've always been there, so you're not noticing it. So then when everything blew up, the town of Adelissa was like, "This happened within our midst. How did it happen?" And there's great regret, I'd say, and great guilt on the part of many of the people. I think they were really fond of these men, genuinely fond, not in a condescending way. I think they accepted them, and so they feel very badly about it. What they keep saying is the men never complained. That is their default argument. The men never complained in their experiences, so they had really nothing to compare it to. So that's why they didn't complain.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost as though they're programmed in a way for mm-hmm. this kind of work. How did the people in the town respond to you? I mean, this is a very small, somewhat isolated rural community, and you know, suddenly it's the focus of something that becomes national news, and here's this, you know, legendary writer from the New York Times coming in to talk to them. What kind of response did you get from them?
You know this feeling where you parachute into a strange place and you know nobody. And you have to summon the nerve to go up to somebody. And you know that what you're asking is complicated and painful and probably something that person doesn't want to talk about. I struggle with that to this day. I've been doing journalism for 30-odd years. That's a difficult assignment.
How'd you do it?
Yeah, I'm a coward. I took the cowardly route. I work oftentimes with photographers, and for many years I've been working with a great photographer named Nicole Benjavino, and she's much more personable than I am, much more approachable. And so she was taking photographs, and she just naturally struck up a conversation with somebody, And we talked with that person. They said, oh, you ought to talk to this person. And went one from one to another to another. So I have to say, in this situation, I took the cowardly route.
Hardly. It sounds like a pretty effective tactic. What a great trick. I'm going to have to try that. Yeah,
I don't know if it was a conceit or a trick. It just happened that way. You know, I'm summoning the nerve to go up to somebody. And then Nicole says, hey, you might want to call this person. You know, I just talked to him.
And there must have been people you met along the way in the reporting who really helped lead you to some breakthroughs. Is there anything that stands out, any particular person who you found was a kind of essential guide through all of this?
All the social workers who took care of these men once they were rescued really were very, very helpful. I think that everyone felt there was a chance here to tell the men's stories, to give voice to the voiceless. You know, they had gone through so much. And now this was their moment to have their story told. So I had a lot of help that way. But there were certain gaps in the narrative that bothered me along the way, because the men kept referring to one man in particular, one of the men who lived in the bunkhouse. His name was Alfred Busby. And they said, yeah, Alfred Busby, he left the bunkhouse and he died. He died. And I didn't know what that meant. And I tried to, you know, sorted out looking through records, and I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find any photographs of them or anything like that. But I knew that when these men say something happened, it happened, okay? It may have happened in 1986 or it may have happened last year, but it happened.
Right.
So I was down in South Carolina for a story related to this, and I tracked down a woman who had worked as a young woman at the bunkhouse as kind of a second or third in command. And she's a wonderful woman, big-hearted woman, yet she's also an example at that time of being wholly unprepared to deal with 36, 40, 50 men with intellectual disability. She's 22, 23 years old. She hasn't gone to school for special education or anything like that. She just got this job. Now she's in charge of helping to supervise them, okay?
And she was from Iowa or?
No, she was from South Carolina near one of the turkey plants, and somehow she winds up in Iowa getting a job there working with these men. So I tracked her down to back in South Carolina, and I'm saying, oh, then you must know Henry Wilkins and you must know Levi. Oh, how's Levi? And I said, yeah, and I'm trying to figure out this story about a guy named Alfred Busby. And we were sitting in a McDonald's in Newberry, South Carolina, drinking coffee, and the TV is blaring above us. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, I'm involved in that story. And I didn't know what she meant. I said, excuse me? She said, I'm involved with how he died. It blew me away. And so all of a sudden, all the noise in the McDonald's goes away, and I'm like locked in. Okay, Terry, her name was Terry Sen. Terry, tell me what happened. And she tells me over the course of the next half hour and over a lot of tears a story about Alfred Busby. He was one of the men, and he did something wrong at the plant. I don't know what he did, but he did some violation that he really shouldn't have done something while handling food, okay? So the men come home that afternoon, and Terry's supervisor says, this was on your watch. You have to punish Alfred. And she said, well, what do you mean? You have to tell him that he can't leave his room and there's no TV. He can't do what he did at work today. Now, she's 23. Alfred Busby is a man in his late 30s or early 40s, and she has to discipline him. She calls him into a room, and she says she reams him out and says, Alfred, no TV tonight. Okay? Alfred, you cannot leave your room. You're telling a grown man he can't watch TV. Alfred is very upset, okay? He goes back to his room. He's mortified, okay? And in their small world, watching TV is like as good as it gets for most of their nights, right? You worked all day at a damn turkey plant. Now you get to watch TV. That's being denied to him. So in the morning, she wakes up to find out that Alfred is gone. What do you mean he's gone? He left. Before the bus goes to the turkey plant, he disappeared. He put on a lightweight jacket and disappears into the January cold of Iowa, and it was snowing, and he disappears. So she tells me what it was like to be sitting in the bunkhouse, hearing the helicopters above clapping as they're looking for Alfred Busby, who's run away. And then she convinces herself that he's run away to Texas. He's okay because he was from Texas. And in fact, one man in particular had already once run away to Texas. So in her mind, he's okay. It doesn't matter that it's -6 degrees out. He's okay. It's the only way she could deal with it. And then, of course, 3 months later, it's the spring thaw in Iowa, and a farmer is going out into his fields, and he sees what looks like a skeleton, and it is a skeleton. It looked like a scarecrow, and it was Alfred Busby. And so I'm in the McDonald's, and this woman tells me this story. She spent the rest of her career working with people with disability, and she's done a lot of training. And she says that she incorporates this story into her training about what not to say, never to yell, never to scold your clients that way, never, and she says it in the McDonald's, never, 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 never. And that was one of those moments where you cannot believe you're sitting here at this McDonald's in South Carolina.
It sounds unforgettable. And it's good to know that it sounds like it's made, you know, an impact not just on her, but on those that she's trained. Mm-hmm. And I imagine this story has made a larger impact as well in terms of, I would hope, you know, treatment of the intellectually disabled. Mm-hmm. Is that the case, or can you kind of bring us up to speed on?
Sure. So let me talk a little bit about the lawsuit. So this all winds up in trial. It goes before a jury, a federal jury. The Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, it takes up the case because they have a window of opportunity because it's involving exploitation in the workplace, okay? And the central argument, or a central argument, that Robert Canino, the EEOC lawyer, made was that these men were denied the enjoyment of life. They suffered the loss of enjoyment of life. And that's the legal phrasing, the loss of enjoyment of life. And that just
striking.
Breaks my heart. Right. It's a simple yet profound statement, loss of enjoyment of life. And so it goes before a jury, and there's no question. The verdict comes out fairly quickly, and it's like this communal outrage, a statement of communal outrage, $240 million verdict in favor of the men. They're never going to see $240 million, okay? There's federal caps on these kinds of jury awards. It's knocked down very quickly to $2 million.
So final question. Where are these men now?
That's a good question. So there were 32 men who were involved in the lawsuit. That's where that number comes from. Four of them have since died. So, you know, you think about it. They serve years of servitude. They're freed. And one guy died within a year. Another guy died 2 years later. Some of the men are living in nursing homes in Texas. Some of them are living in Waterloo, Iowa, where they are in suburban neighborhoods. Some of them go to work. Some of them don't want to work anymore. A lot of them have girlfriends. A lot of them have been baptized. They've gone to churches. And a few of the men live independently, which is startling because that means that 10 years ago they were living in this squalid bunkhouse because they were effectively trapped. But given the opportunity and with some support services, they're living independently in houses by themselves and making do. You'll see them at the supermarket. You'll see them at the sports bar. You'll see them at church. They're among us.
And they could have been on their own.
All along.
Wow. Well, as I said at the top of the conversation, it's a devastating story, and I'm so glad that you wrote it and that you came in to talk to us about it.
Oh, thanks so much, Joaquin. Really, I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to the podcast. Join us again next week.